Next up, Invader Moon. Rob Schelsky back with us on Coast to Coast. Moon Mysteries. Wait till you hear what he has to say next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Rob Schelsky has almost 25 years of experience investigating the paranormal, a lifelong interest, of course, as an investigative columnist for Alien Skin magazine for a number of years. He has done on-site investigations both for the magazine and on his own. Rob's focus is on the UFO phenomenon, the possible involvement of the moon as a base of operations for them, and the implicit dangers of UFOs overall and what they mean to all of us. Rob, welcome back. You've got another hit here. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Good. All is well on the front, and you've been busy these days, I hear.
Pretty much, yeah. I've been involved in a lot of MUFON field investigation work writing these books for another thing, and not to mention all the research that goes with them.
When you were with us, and we talked about For the Moon is Hollow, Aliens Rule the Sky, the new book is called Invader Moon. Tell us the difference.
Well, Invader Moon is kind of the end product of two other books. It is the end product of the Hollow Moon book, as well as also Ancient Alien Empire, Megalithia. What I found out was that, like so many writers, I tend to assemble a lot of facts in my books, and I don't really come to any real conclusions, although with Hollow Moon I kind of had my own theory, of course. But I wanted to see if I could somehow put them in context and come up with some other answers. And I needed a framework, so I thought of a timeline. So I did this timeline, started putting pieces of the puzzle on the timeline, and I came up with some, I think, rather startling conclusions.
A lot of people have talked about the moon as being towed into place, that it might be hollow, of course, and you believe that as well. How do you think the moon got there? And, of course, the latest report, scientific report, was a collision with another celestial body. Earth,
right.
Earth collided and out popped the moon.
Actually, that's not the latest. It was the georeactor theory that came out right after that, because they had some problems with the impact theory, and they were trying to resolve them by saying, well, maybe there was a large fissionable mass at the equator of the Earth. The Earth was spinning rapidly, this blew, and it caused the moon.
Threw it off.
It has more problems than the impact theory, so they backed off, and now, yeah, it's the impact theory again.
Yeah, back it is. And that's the one that sounds the most palatable, I think.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, it does answer some questions, but it creates others. For instance, if you smash two planets together, and it was a planet supposedly the size of Mars or close to it, called Theia, and you smack it into the Earth and they both basically blow themselves into pieces, the moon should be made of both the moon and
Theia. That's right.
I mean, I'm sorry, the Earth and Theia, and it isn't. There's no sign of any Theia material on the moon at all.
And where's the other material from Theia? I mean, is it just in planet Earth? That doesn't make sense either, does it?
Well, it seems to be coming from the mantle of the planet Earth, but then there's some oddities about that, too. There's Neptunium on the moon, and there's almost none of it on Earth because it has a short half-life. I believe it's about 2.5 million years. So by this point in time, it should all have degraded. And on the Earth, it apparently has. On the moon, it apparently hasn't. And there's a lot of helium-3 on the moon. There isn't on the Earth. There's a lot of titanium on the moon, and titanium on the Earth is pretty rare in the surface mantle layer. So there are a lot of oddities that we just can't account for, even with the impact theory.
Will we ever get those answers? I guess we have to go back, don't we?
Yeah, we have to go back if we're ever going to be allowed to go back, which I question.
Well, that's always that possibility. I've got to ask you this too, Rob. There's been more stories coming out about Neil Armstrong when he was on the moon with Buzz Aldrin and what they really saw out there. Have you taken a look at that part of that story? I mean, did they indeed see UFOs on the other side of craters staring at, as Armstrong said, they look like they're looking at us?
Yes, and I think that's where the idea of us being warned off the moon probably originates from. We have no actual hard, concrete evidence. Neil Armstrong himself has never come out and said this to our knowledge, but apparently they have spoken about it to others. Now, it's hearsay. However, the hearsay is from fairly reliable sources, so one would assume that there's a plausibility about them that there wouldn't be otherwise.
Now, Michael Cremo, of course, who's been a regular guest, claims that civilizations are much older than what mainstream science is telling us. And you believe we've had ancient worldwide civilizations as well. You call them the pre-Adamites. Tell me about them.
Right. The pre-Adamite civilization, the one I'm speaking of in particular, predates the Great Flood. And it basically was a worldwide civilization. Its character was that it had a ruling class, and above that was an alien class, and that the population of the Earth was not large, and that the pre-Adamites did not have a huge impact on the Earth itself. People ask, well, where's that layer of archaeological evidence for the pre-Adamites? And my response is, well, we have a lot of evidence to show that they didn't make a large impact, that they came with their technology. They didn't develop it here, so you wouldn't have layer upon layer of evidence of their history.
Were they visitors?
The pre-Adamites, probably more than visitors. We were probably a colonial world of some sort. Either we had strategic importance to the powers that be, or we were a great resource for certain minerals like gold. Gold is very rare. People say, well, yeah, but there's gold all over the universe. Well, actually, there isn't. Gold is rare all over the universe, apparently.
And you got to find it. And if you do, you're going to go for it, aren't you?
Right, exactly, because it's just not that easily come by. It doesn't form like a lot of our other elements do in a nova, supernova, or even a hypernova. Apparently, something like two neutron stars have to collide in order for there to be gold as a byproduct in any quantity at all. In a hypernova, for instance, some gold is formed, but a lot of it's reabsorbed back into the star itself as it collapses into a black hole or a spinning neutron star.
Rob, how close does your theory of the pre-Adamites echo the late Zechariah Sitchin's theories of the Anunnaki coming down here to genetically alter whatever was on this planet at the time? Any similarities there?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities there. I think he has a lot of it on the mark. And I think I found that out from independent sources as well. I mean, it isn't just Sitchin saying this, but you can gather evidence from a number of sources. You get hard evidence, you get written evidence, you get oral histories, and you can also get like genetic evidence as well. And if you start putting all these pieces to this puzzle together, you start to paint a bigger picture. And that picture is that it did exist, and that it was here, and that the Great Flood time period was when it ended. And the magic year seems to be about 10,000 BC, approximately 12,000 years ago. That is a number that comes up over and over and over in my research, 12,000 years.
And it's ironic, too, that they are now saying that the Sphinx is much older than anybody had thought, and that you could see erosion, water erosion on the Sphinx about that same time period.
Yes, exactly. And also they're beginning to think now that the pyramids are older than we thought, too. They found the fossil of a sea urchin on one of the lower blocks of the pyramid.
And I love that.
Scientists are saying, well, that can't be. It's just a fossil from the rock that they quarried from the quarry, the stone. And the archaeologist, and it is an archaeologist, by the way, who's claiming this, Sharif El Morsi, I believe his name is, he says, no, this is a fresh fossil. It doesn't show the erosion pattern that it should if it had been exposed to the elements all those thousands of years, and it indicates that there was once a shallow sea or lagoon there.
Now, these pre-Adamites, what happened to them? Did they stay on the planet? Did they get eradicated during the flood, or did they leave?
Well, it was more than a flood. When the moon arrived about 12,000 years ago, it was more than just a flood. There was, I think, a bombardment, too. We have a lot of examples of that. And the pre-Adamites were, for want of a better name, are the Nephilim, or the Watchers.
Okay.
And I imagine most of them were abandoned by their overlords, the aliens, and they had to fend for themselves, and they didn't do very well. They were the race of giants, as we think of it, and they were bright. They had elongated skulls. They were pretty darn intelligent, but they simply were being outnumbered by us after the Great Flood. Their population declined even as our grew. There's a direct correlation between the two.
Were they human or were they alien?
I think the pre-Adamites that ruled the planet were a hybrid. I think they I don't think the aliens could live here very well. We have a lot of carvings and bas reliefs and that sort of thing that show them in what look like environmental suits, space suits. So I get the feeling that they, in order to function here And Sitchin says it in his stories about the Anunnaki, that they had to develop a race that could work for them, do the dirty work for them, so to speak. But I think it wasn't because they were lazy. I think it's because they had a hard time doing it themselves, stumbling around in environmental suits.
Does Atlantis fit into any of this, Rob?
Yes, it does, because I go by Plato. I know there's a lot of theories of where Atlantis is, but Plato was the original one who talked about it. All sources lead back to Plato. He's the ultimate source for it. And he says it existed 9,000 years before his time. He was about 2,400 years ago. So again, we're talking right around that 12,000-year figure that Atlantis supposedly was destroyed. Again, you have a lot of sources of information, and they all seem to lead back to that same time. And I think Atlantis was probably a pre-Adamite colony or civilization, and I think it bit the dust because a competing alien race or races decided it was time for them to lose control of the Earth.
Just an amazing time period here. Now, let's talk a little bit about the moon, because this ties into everything we've been talking about, Invader Moon. In your opinion, we've heard the scientific rationale for how the moon got created. In your opinion, how did it get here?
Well, I think it was brought here, and in my book, Invader Moon, I state that pretty clearly. The hollow moon is the initial premise for the idea. Again, I'm not sure if the moon is entirely hollow or has large caverns, but I do think it was brought here. There's just a lot of evidence to suppose that, and I think it was brought here for a specific reason, and that was to wrest control of those who were in charge of the Earth at the time. The Vedic texts talk about up to 400 different alien races. They talk about a battle that took place on the moon itself. And I think the moon was basically a Death Star. It controlled the high ground. And once it took a position, it proceeded to do a bombardment. I think its approach caused tidal waves or tsunamis along all the coastlines. And I think the pre-Adamites were just hit with one thing after another. I don't think they had much chance, really.
Now, by towing the moon into place, what was the specific purpose of the moon? I mean, obviously, we need the moon to exist. It has done some amazing things for us. Is that why it was brought here?
I'm not quite sure about that. My personal opinion is no. I don't think it was brought here to please us. I don't think it was brought here to help us. I think we talk about, you need the tides. The tides, we have tides from the Coriolis effect of the Earth spinning. We have tides from the sun's gravitational pull. The moon adds more power to the tides at times, creating a spring tide effect, for instance. But I think that's probably just a byproduct. I think the moon was brought here to conquer, to control, to wrest control of this area of space from others. I think, according to the Vedic text, there was basically an interstellar war going on. Whether we were in a strategic area of that war, I don't know. But I think it was a long-term Cold War that suddenly turned hot. I think it's gone cold again, by the way.
What would make it go cold again? What happened?
Well, as in all battles and wars, the battles move on.
Yeah.
You don't fight the same battle over and over in the same area. I think they kind of were trying that for a long time on a low-key level. The Vedic texts talk about that, too, that there are ongoing skirmishes and, basically what amounted to brush fire wars. But ultimately, it came to a head, and I think the end result for the Earth was devastation. I think there were was a bombardment. I think there were nukes set off, like in Mohenjo-Daro and Hadrop. And I think there was also other types of bombardment, maybe asteroids. We have evidence of a crown fire across North America right at that time. We lose all our great mammals in North America right at that time. We have flooding of coastlines and the sudden melting of the glaciers. And, again, it's all right at that time.
Huh. I'm convinced, biblically, when you read the account of Sodom and Gomorrah, to me, it sounds like a nuclear explosion, doesn't it, Rob?
Sounds exactly like a nuclear explosion, yes. I think you're absolutely right, George.
And, my God, ancient Indian texts talk about, battles in the sky, flying machines. Something happened on this planet a long, long time ago. Why doesn't science really dive into that? These are the greatest mysteries of all times, and they just don't touch it. How come?
I know. I find that rather strange myself. Science is slow to change. It develops theories and it likes them and it wants to stick with them. It takes a great deal of effort to shift them. I've spoken to two archaeologists, both from California, one from around San Francisco, one from around L.A., and they privately say that there are a lot of problems in archaeology. Even the dating methods have real problems. We talk about these megalithic stone monuments and things like the platform in Baalbek, Lebanon.
Yeah.
But we don't know the age of them. We know the age of the rock that makes them up, which is millions of years old. But unless you find tools or implements from around that time, chipping tools, you know, that sort of thing, you can't really tell the age of the object itself except through secondary means. So there's a lot left unsaid. And with the question of Upart, we have over 3,000 pieces of evidence of Upart from around the world over the last several centuries. And science basically just ignores them.
I know
it. Put it down to a hoax, or more often than not, they just won't comment on it.
It's frustrating. But you know, if you read the ancient manuscripts and clearly think about it in terms of modern events of today, it all makes sense. You know, again, like Sodom and Gomorrah, and if episodes like that, it all makes sense. The fallen angel story in Genesis, to me, is a natural UFO visitation story.
And I suppose you've also talked on your show about the fact that Rh negative people might be distantly related to the Nephilim.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I'm Rh negative, by the way. I'm B negative.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I'm O positive.
Well, you're nice and normal.
Sometimes normal's good, sometimes not.
And sometimes it's a matter of relativity, right?
How did you come up with the 12,000-year figure that the moon was brought here?
Well, the evidence just says that something happened, and it comes from different sources. Again, we have the destruction of Atlantis right around 12,000 years ago. We have the end of a major glaciation period that just ended right at about the same time. And also, on my timeline, I found something rather strange. When you put the timeline together, the first thing you notice is that civilization started, as we know it, about 5,500 years ago. This is when the majority of archaeologists say it really kicked off, and it was an overnight explosion. And then you have this long period I call a stagnant period, and it takes place for 6,500 years prior to the rise of our civilization. So from the time of the end of the glaciers to the time of the rise of civilization, we have millennia where human beings exist. They have small villages, they're hunters and gatherers, and they do make some things and do grow some food, but they don't seem to accomplish anything. They don't seem to evolve in their culture or their technology. And I started looking at that, and it reminded me of something. The Roman Empire, after it fell, we had the same thing. It lasted several centuries, the Dark Ages. And I began to wonder, was this a sort of Dark Age period? Why would humans not do anything for 6,500 years and then suddenly they kick off with civilization?
And go crazy after that.
And go crazy. Yeah. The archaeologists refer to it as an overnight explosion. So I began to think, were they recovering from something really horrific that happened? And again, that 12,000 year keeps coming up in all sorts of ways.
What was it about this planet, Rob, that made it so enticing for ETs to come here?
There's a number of possible reasons. It could be that they were just expanding and we were there. Maybe we were of interest. Maybe they saw possibilities in us. Number two, it could be for strategic reasons. We might just be in an area of space that at the time, at least, was important. Maybe a number of cultures were clashing out there, and we were one of those fulcrums or focal points for it, a nexus sort of thing. The third thing is maybe it's for the metals, the gold.
Yeah.
Heavy metals, not only gold, but others, are not produced the normal way. They're hard to come by. The Earth seems to have an abundance of them. And they obviously were mining them. We have mines that date back 50,000 years, 250,000 years, 40,000 years, 15,000 years, 30,000 years.
With high technology, too. Stay with us. Rob Shelsky with us. We're talking about his latest work called Invader Moon. Next hour, we'll take your questions with him. Welcome back to Coast, Rob Shelsky with us. His latest work is called Invader Moon. We'll tell you where you can get that book with great stories in there. Rob, you have talked about underground tunnels and caves. What do you think they were for? And if there was an alien race living inside the planet, might they still be?
Well, with the underground tunnels and caves, I think they were shelters. The Hopi Indians, for example, said that they sheltered below the earth in great caverns, and the ant people, as they referred to them, didn't finally help them to come to the surface when it was safe to do so. There's not a lot of sense in having these tunnels. They have them all over Europe, for instance, and Scotland. You have these tunnels that go from, anywhere from 300 meters to 700 meters, and they're underground. And people and the archaeologists say, well, they might have been, they don't have an answer, of course, they might have been to get from point A to point B safely. Yet, if you can build a tunnel like that, couldn't you just easily build a shelter above ground or a couple of fences along a line if you're worried about wild animals? Whatever this was, I think it was to hide and protect them from something aerial, something in the skies. And I think this is why they did this. In China, for example, they have the, I'm going to murder the pronunciation, but the Longyu Caves. And this is a series of caverns separate from each other but close to each other, all carved meticulously, all have grooves in the ceiling, they have columns, they have grooves in the wall, grooves in the floor. These obviously were highly machined, and there's no sign of what use they were for, and there's no history of them at all. As far as the Chinese are concerned, and they kept meticulous records, they didn't exist and never were in any records at all. Yet these caves exist. There were no stone implements in them, no sign of anyone having lived there, died there, eaten there, anything. And yet, they're so close together, and they weren't connected. They're all separate, almost like repositories, storage areas, or vaults of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this all around the planet. There are underground cities in Turkey, in Cappadocia, and these date way back to right supposedly at the time of the start of civilization or before. And they have tunnels in them that are so wide you could drive a car through them. And successive peoples lived in them, but we don't know who the original inhabitants were or why they were built in the first place. I think the answer is obvious. I think they had gone through a time of bombardment not all that long before, and this was their way of staying safe.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. It really does. The question is, of course, could they still be there?
Well, as far as the aliens underground go, I'm more inclined to think they're probably underwater. We have a lot of evidence of UFOs
submersibles
out of the oceans and lakes. Yeah, exactly. But we also have some evidence of them going down into mountain ranges and not coming back out. Nor do we see anything on the ground when they do this. So, yeah, they could be entering caverns or tunnels that way, too.
That would be exciting and perplexing at the same time. Rob, where do we get the book Invader Moon?
Invader Moon you can get through Simon & Schuster. They distribute it. You can also get it from Amazon. You can get it either on the shelves or ordering it through Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. It's basically everywhere. Or, of course, you can get it at Permuted Press itself, who is actually doing the publishing of the book.
Do you think this toad moon theory also is there to create a shield for us? Has it saved planet Earth over the years?
It may have saved us from other alien species. If the thing is sort of like a Death Star, if it was meant to be big and powerful and command the high ground, it not only knocked out those who were on Earth because they couldn't stand up against it,
mm-hmm.
but it also would pretty much act as a bolster against any other invading alien races or species. So yes, it could.
Why does it look so pocketed as a celestial object? Could that have been just a covering, some kind of cloaking device?
I have a feeling it was meant to try to look as natural as possible, but it doesn't really look all that natural. The far side of the moon is all craters, all the way, all of it. The near side has large flat areas we call mares. And Latin for seas, because they were dark and flat and looked like seas to the old observers from Earth. Excuse me. And so the moon isn't quite as natural looking as one would think it is. Plus, the shallow craters are the small ones, are the big ones, and the deep craters are the small ones. It's almost as if anything that impacted it, if it was small, it could penetrate as far as it needed to, so it created a deeper hole. But when it was a large object and made a big crater, it could only go so far before it bounced back and caused a lava flow that flattened out the interior of that crater. So again, you have this disparity between small craters being deep and large craters being flat. We which is also very strange. There's another interesting thing, too. I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but we have meteorites from the moon and from Mars. And one would think if the moon had been here a long time that there would be more meteorites from the moon found on the Earth than from Mars. That's not the case. We have about 14 pounds of each, approximately. And Mars is much farther away, almost 65 million miles at some points in its orbit. The moon is only 250,000 miles away, and yet we have the same number of meteorites from both. That doesn't make sense if the moon has been here since the beginning of time. It just, where are all the other meteorites that should have been landing on Earth from the moon during all that
time?
Yeah,
it doesn't add up, does it?
Mm-mm. No, that was another piece of evidence I had. Again, it's like putting a jigsaw puzzle together. You find these bits and pieces and start putting them together, and it builds this picture.
David Jacobs believes that ETs are bad, that they have something nefarious planned, and it's not good. What do you think?
I absolutely agree. I don't know that all ETs are bad, but the ones that are basically as they've been referred to and as I have referred to them in the past as space brothers, they seem okay, but they don't seem to interfere with the bad ones. So for all intents and purposes, we have to worry about the bad ones, and I think they have nothing good planned for us. If they had, why wouldn't they come out in the open, number one? And number two, why would they abduct people against their will, violating their human rights? They're not stupid. They have to be highly intelligent to sail through space like they do. So they must know what we feel is right and what we feel is wrong, even if they don't have that concept. So if they feel the need to just brook all sorts of moral codes to do whatever they want to do, whether they're innately evil or just don't care, it doesn't really matter for us because the end result is the same. It's not good.
Could all this be, this breeding program, be to one day take over the planet with these hybrids that they're creating?
Again, it's rather hard to say. There's a lot of side legends about the Great Flood that one of the reasons for it was to get rid of the Nephilim. That was one way to get rid of them. And again, that ties in with my idea of a battle where they're trying to remove the powers that be on Earth from the Earth, one way or the other. They didn't care. More recently, well, again, we have that Rh negative factor, which seems to be a holdover from another time. There is other evidence of interfering in our civilization, too. We do have, in our past, people with elongated skulls that were not the result of binding, but actually seem to be genuinely elongated skulls. They had a 25% larger brain capacity. We found some 300 of these types of skulls in Paracas, Peru, I think it was. Might be Chile. I'm getting my geography a little mixed. But the end result was that those skulls had fewer sutures than the normal human skull, or that the bound skulls would have had. They had a larger brain capacity. And you can squash a skull into any shape you want to. But a skull is a skull. It only has so much bone matter, supposedly. But these elongated skulls have more. They are bigger, with a greater brain capacity. So the end result is, that doesn't seem normal.
No, it does not seem normal.
It doesn't account for it. We can't account for the fact that not only is it a bigger brain capacity, but the skull is structured to accommodate it, and there are fewer sutures in the skull.
I mean, there comes a time that logic has to step in. And when you look at all these possible signs of ET intervention, you have to conclude that we are and we were being visited.
Well, I think we were. And I think we've been interfered with on an ongoing basis. There was a major mutation in Central Europe about 4,700 years ago to about 7,000 years ago. Central Europeans were dark-skinned and light-eyed. And all of a sudden, it switched. We became light-skinned. Now, some people said, well, this was the result of the Ice Age. They became light-skinned because it works better in a cold environment than darker skin does. Unfortunately, at the time this occurred, the Ice Age was already over. So how do we account for this sudden mutation? How do we account for Rh negative factors? Rh negative just doesn't seem to make sense. They don't think it was the result of a mutation, a natural mutation. So if not, then what was it the result of? How is it that we can have people who if they marry other people, one's Rh negative and one's Rh positive, the child can die as a result? It's a big problem.
When you have talked about the pre-Adamites, That, of course, opens up the door for Adam after the fact. What was the need of creating him when you already had the pre-Adamites on this planet?
Well, I hate to contradict religion, but I don't think he was the first. I use the term pre-Adamite in a non-religious sense. It's convenient. You could probably say antediluvian as well, pre-flood. But the common term seems to be pre-Adamite. But I think humans were around. I think they were around well before that, and our archaeological records seem to show that humans did survive for a long time. And in fact, we survived long enough to have interbred with the Neanderthals. But again, now you're talking tens of thousands of years. We didn't accomplish anything more than discover fire and use tools, and yet nothing happened. And then you get this period where there's an overlay. You get what seems to be a world language that's pre-Sanskrit. You get the rise of the megalithic culture, and we can't really date it for the reasons I've stated in many respects. And you get, you get some odd things happening with technology. For instance, in Pumapunku, they had these metal clamps helping to hold the blocks together, the H blocks together. Yeah. They've determined that they had to have been poured molten metal into the stones themselves in situ, rather than making them and then somehow hammering them into the stone, because there's no sign of that. So these people were using portable smelters around 15,000 years ago. And here's the kicker. We don't have any sign anywhere in that area or around the world that prior to this, there was the development of smelters or forging like this. In fact, 15,000 years ago, it was non-existent. And then all of a sudden we have this portable smelter situation to do these things, and then afterwards it disappears. We also found this was true in Egypt. They had the same sort of thing there as well, and a couple of other places. And then all of a sudden it was there, it wasn't there, then it was there, and then it was gone again. And that's why I think the overlay civilization had an impact, and we do see signs of it, but not as much as someone might think. Something else to remember, 10,000 years is a long time. Things crumbled to dust. Every sign of modern civilization would cease to exist within 10,000 years.
Be gone, totally.
All gone, completely. Roads, skyscrapers, everything. Even glass wouldn't be glass anymore.
Yeah, it just breaks down. The steel would break down, everything would break down.
Exactly. So we're talking 12,000 years here. How much of a record do we expect to find at this point in time? We're lucky we found what we have.
Well, that's a good point. You had mentioned earlier, Rob, about submersible UFOs. That has always fascinated me ever since I've heard a few reports of Navy folks on ships. They saw, tracking lights in the ocean, and then all of a sudden it burst right through and off it went. Those are an amazing series of stories. Why do they hide down there?
It's a convenient place to hide. It's one place we can't get to. We know more about the moon than we know about the bottom of our ocean. We can map it with sonar, but that really doesn't tell us what we really need to know. We just get a general topographical overlay. But is that rounded hump down there a hill, or is it a dome? We don't know.
We don't know. And I hope we keep checking. I'm glad we've got people like you that continue to research these incredible stories, because it doesn't happen anymore. Are younger kids interested in this, where they go out and research this?
I don't know, but when I advertised the fact that I was going to be on your show, I've gotten all sorts of emails from people that I never expected to get emails from. And some believe in UFOs, but also are very religious. I don't want to call them cults.
Mm-hmm.
I like to respect everyone's belief systems, and I don't think anyone's belief system is a cult necessarily. But by the same token, a lot of them seem quite young. And being a MUFON member, I just attended a meeting. And we had a 14-year-old boy come in there and asked me what it was all about. I told him, and he was exceedingly interested and took a pamphlet. So I think you have some of the young who are interested, some who are not, unfortunately.
My 8-year-old grandson, Gavin, was firing away at me today about UFOs, extraterrestrial life. 8 years old, Rob. It's amazing.
I was interested in it at about the age of 6. And I don't know why, but I was intensely interested from then on throughout my entire adult life as well. Some people are either involved in it or not. I'm not quite sure why. I'm not quite sure why some people have this fascination and others don't. But it seems to be an ongoing thing, doesn't it?
When you read Genesis and it talks about the Nephilim and the fallen angels, what is your opinion of that?
I think it's probably pretty close to the truth. I'm not at all sure about the Bible being unbiased, because it is written through the eyes of very religious people. But I do think they're recording history as they were told that history in many respects. I think the Nephilim were real. I think they were the watchers. And I think the reason the term watchers is so prevalent in it is because that's what they were. They watched and oversaw the human race digging their gold and things for them. They acted as the overseers for their alien overlords. And I think the term watchers is very apt for that reason. Everyone says, well, what were they watching? Well, they were watching us.
Yes, they were, like a microscope.
Mm-hmm. And they were and watching in the sense of telling us what to do and making sure we did it.
Did they like us?
I think the Nephilim did. All the records seem to indicate they interbred with us. The Bible talks about that. The sons of God and the daughters of man. And I keep harping on that RH factor, but that seems to be one sign of this. But also, there are a lot of legends of around the world of women giving birth to giants or trying to and dying in childbirth because of it. And I think this was a real thing. I think there was some crossbreeding. So I think you have the Nephilim, who some were wise rulers, good rulers, did their best for us, but they still had to be subservient to their alien overlords.
We talked a little bit about Atlantis, Rob. Sunken civilizations seem to be all over the planet, don't they?
Oh, they are. They are. They are in fact, and they are in legend. And every civilization has stories of sunken cities. And as it turns out, for instance, with the Greeks, they were true. They talk about various cities that sunk beneath the waves, and we found out that, like, for instance, one of them, and I won't try to pronounce the name, it's hideously long, very Greek, and Palpateri or something like that. And it apparently sunk during the time of the Peloponnesian Wars, but was a commerce center. And up until very recently, we thought it was a myth. Well, it turns out it wasn't. It's there. It's about 3 to 7 meters underwater. And they haven't done much investigating of it yet, but we know that it exists. Alexandria, a big portion of it, is underwater.
Yeah.
The lighthouse of Alexandria is underwater. Part of the palace of Cleopatra is underwater. But we also have the city of Ys off the coast of France, and we have other cities around, including mysterious islands that come and go, such as High Brazil.
They pop up, right?
And pop up, yeah. High Brazil has been noticed over and over again by several captains. It's supposed to be west of Ireland and east of the United States. And it's been talked about for centuries, and now it seems to be gone again. But we also have, I believe it's Sandy Island in the South Pacific or Western Pacific. And this is a very strange place. It appeared on maps for a couple of centuries. And then recently, people said, oh, no, it's not really there. It's a mistake.
Huh.
And it was a mistake that was compounded. The island was about 24 kilometers long, maybe, 5.5 kilometers wide. But successive captains of ships recorded seeing it in their log.
And now it's gone?
And now it's gone. I saw myself an image on a Google map. It shows the island, shows the shape of the island and size of it, and it's all pixelated. Now, normally Google doesn't pixelate.
Hold on, Rob. We're already at the top of the hour. Let's come back and talk about that and take some phone calls next with Rob Shelsky as we talk about his special book, Invader Moon.